The Tom Woods Show, episode 2038.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey folks, Tom Woods here. Don't forget you can get one of my books in audiobook format for free. So that includes my book, Real Descent, which is narrated by me. My New York Times bestseller, Meltdown on the Financial Crisis of 2008, featuring a foreword by Ron Paul, Nullification, and others. Just head over to tomwoodsaudio.com, sign up for Audible, and if you decide you don't want Audible, you get to keep the free audiobook they give you anyway. tomwoodsaudio.com. Hey everybody, Tom Woods here. Michael Malice Week continues. We've been talking a bit about his book, The Anarchist Handbook, now that the audiobook version is available, and you'll recall that the audiobook version features a variety of different people from across our little world reading the different chapters. So it's like Roger Waters when he did Pink Floyd's The Wall live at the site of the Berlin Wall. He brought in all these celebrity musicians to perform alongside him. So Michael here has done the same thing with the Anarchist Handbook. So that makes the audiobook all the more enjoyable to listen to. So I'm one of the readers, Dave Smith, but also many, many other people whose names you will recognize. Well, today we're going to take a little bit of a peek behind the curtain at, we're going to be a little bit meta today, at the actual process behind getting a book published, because there are interesting stories around that. Of course, if you yourself have any interest in having a book published, this episode would be even greater value to you. But I think either way, it's interesting to know. Like, for example, I'm not a musician at all, but I love hearing behind-the-scenes stories and knowing what really goes into that concert that I just watched and stuff like that. I love that. And I don't get why people aren't more curious about that. Remember my favorite play, The Play That Goes Wrong? When they gave audience members the opportunity to tour the backstage area if they just made a donation, I jumped at that. I just love that stuff. I want the backstory. I want the details. I want to know everything that's going on. So we're going to supply you with that today as two people who have extensive experience publishing books. All right, Michael, you and I have experience in self-publishing. Of course, we've been published by traditional publishers and self-publishing. So we want to talk a little bit about all these sorts of questions. Like, how do you actually do it? Like, what are the steps? And you had some unique challenges, actually, with the Anarchist Handbook. People might think that because it was a compilation that you'd have fewer headaches. But no, actually, there are more. But first, can you say a quick word about, there are pros and cons to both. It's not always completely stupid to go with a mainstream publisher, or do you think it is?
No, it's absolutely not the case. And I got to tell you, people who like to make these blanket proclamations about other people's situations without understanding the context, it's really rarely good advice.
Right, I agree.
So if you're like, oh, you should never? I mean, if you're the president, or if you're, or it's a vanity project, it's nonsensical. So there's many reasons why someone should go through a mainstream publisher. But at the same time, for the vast majority of listeners and me as well, it's very hard to get a book deal. It's not at all the case that if you have a demonstrated audience that, a book deal is basically, they come knocking on your door. Publishing is in very bad shape. And the publishing industry, the economics of it are pretty idiosyncratic. And how it works is, what's it called? Like a superstar economy, where you have a very few select items that are basically carrying the burden for the rest of the items. I think that's the economic term. So you'll have, like, let's suppose they'll publish, let's say, 200 books, but of those 200, it's the 15 that are earning enough profits to generate to keep the house above water.
Right. That's what I hear about airplanes, that the first class basically is subsidizing everybody else.
Oh, wow. That's interesting to know. Okay. Yeah. So there's certain things that if you get a corporate publisher will be of use to you. One is, it's going to be a lot easier, if not impossible otherwise, to get reviews. The New York Times or the Wall Street Journal or Publishers Weekly, they're really not touching a book that hasn't come through with a mainstream publisher. If you have an independent publisher, which in my opinion is the worst of all worlds, then you're lucky if you're going to get acknowledged at all. I think Publishers Weekly is actually pretty good with that. They do tend to you know, give notice to the littler guy. But if you're doing it independently as an individual, I mean, then you're really going to be up against it. With a corporate publisher, you're going to have an editor, which is very much could be a curse or a blessing. You're going to have a copy editor. They're going to lay it out for you. They're going to have a guy who designs the cover. They're going to handle distribution. They're going to handle printing. So these are all things that you're going to get, but you're going to have to jump through an awful lot of hoops.
So in terms of self-publishing, is it the case that if you're self-published, your book just will not be in the bookstores? It's going to be available online only.
I know Milo, when he had his book a few years ago, and this became a huge thing, he somehow got it through, but that's like, it's really, really hard. The other instances is someone like, and don't quote me on this exactly, like Dave Asprey. He's an early paleo primal blueprint guy. So when you are like making a niche market and you have the book that basically launched this market, those books will get into bookstores. But at the same time, Barnes & Noble is not a sustainable business model. You and I remember very vividly when we were kids, Coconuts, Sam Goody, The Wiz, Tower Records, whatever it was in your local store. But now CD stores are not really viable because you have Amazon, you have online retailers. So I don't think bookstores are long for this world.
Right. And so to me, it's more of a vanity thing to be able to say, hey, there's my book in the bookstore. It's not really central.
The books in the bookstores, I mean, their stock is very, very low in terms of the quantity of the books that are out there. I mean, if you're at the airport, right, those are like the top, you know, 0.01%. And then if you're at your local, it depends on how big the store is, obviously, but there's very few books that are actually in the stores.
Right. I mean, especially when you consider every single year, there's something like 200,000 more titles.
Oh, it's crazy. Yeah.
It's insane. And so also think of the book, as I said in a previous episode, not always as the final thing, but as a calling card for you, as a way for people to take you seriously or consider you to be an authority on something. It opens doors for you. You get speaking engagements. It's not just the, I make $3 a book and that's the end of it. You should parlay it into something further. And then your comment about you're going to have an editor if you have a traditional publisher. I find, maybe we could compare experiences here, but in general, most editors just frustrate me, and I'm going to be extremely blunt. I'm a better writer than these editors are, in most cases. And so the edits they make, I don't even like them. I guarantee you just made that worse. So that's one problem.
I'm going to just back you up. Most editors, like most humans, are not impressive people.
Yeah, unfortunately, that is the case. Now, there is an exception, and I'm very happy to acknowledge it. Do you know Tim Carney?
Of course, he's great.
He was my editor on Meltdown, and I had to write that at breakneck speed. So it was good when I submitted it, but you know, Mexico was not sending its best with that first draft. And he really...
Is this your confession of doing some very nefarious things?
He made it better, though. I'll tell you, he came up with some great analogies. He helped to rearrange like the order of it. And actually, this chapter should go here and this one there. I feel much, much better about it because of that particular editor. But I will say just one other quick thing. I do have a book with Columbia University Press, and there I had a really top-notch editor, I have to say. Really, really good. And every single change she made, I would say, yeah, that's great. But the thing we struggled on was, I'm not a boomer, but the overemphasis on gender-neutral language can get tiresome. And so there would be cases where I would say, okay, I could understand how we want to change the wording there. But there were other cases where it just sounded grotesque. Anyone can tell that. And so she was kind of on my team. She was saying, look, I have to comply with what Columbia wants. So what would happen is I would say, all right, I'd like to make this change, this change, this change. She'd say, well, you can probably get two out of those three. Which two do you want? You know, that's all right. I can live with that one. I want to make the other two changes. Whereas if it's your book and you're publishing it yourself, you can do whatever you want. You can be he the whole time if you want to. Nobody cares.
Yeah, and there's things that they do which really rankle with me. Like they insist that T-shirt should be capitalized and dumpster. And it's like, because dumpster is a brand name. And it's like the thing that really is my biggest pet peeve, and I've mentioned this before, and there's times when I can see why something is technically correct, But this is an example where it's both technically and colloquially incorrect. They would try to insist when you're writing out an address in New York that would say like 14 East 73rd Street, and they would write out S-E-V-E-N-T-Y, right? Oh. The street signs don't say spell it out. The street signs say number 7, number 3, R-D. So when they're trying to be correct, not only are they, does it look stupid, it's not accurate to the signage.
Yeah. And it's you against their style manual. And unfortunately, you know.
But like, what is, first of all, it's not accurate intellectually because East 73rd Street is not literally the 73rd Street. It's the 73rd Street after Houston, but there's many streets below Houston. So it even gives the impression inaccurately that it's some kind of numeric sequence that, you know, it's the 73rd Street.
Right, right, right. So these things are annoying. Okay, just very quickly.
What's annoying is it's not just annoying. It just speaks to the mentality. And this is a very midwit thing that you're up against a population who outsources their creativity or decision-making process and insists on imposing rules without knowing or appreciating what those rules are designed to do. It's like the inverse of Chesterton's fence, right? Chesterton had that metaphor of before you tear down a fence, you really make sure you know why it was put up to begin with. You know, no one builds a fence in the middle of a field for no reason. It's there for some reason. Now, maybe that purpose has passed away or is no longer relevant, but you really better be darn sure that there aren't, you know, Bigfoot or Mongolians on the other side of that fence before you tear it down. And here it's kind of the inverse of that. It's that, okay, we have these rules to serve a purpose. One is to have kind of unanimity across our books, clarity of thought, to look professional and to read in a certain way. But many such cases, these rules are deleterious to the ostensible goal.
Right. So it's a bureaucratic mentality. I'm the bureaucrat. Yes. I'm here to enforce the rules.
Yes.
I don't make the rules, sir. Okay. All right. So there are reasons that you might want to go the traditional route, but I think those reasons are diminishing. I mean, one is, I mean, for example, when you wrote The New Right, you did that with St. Martin's.
Correct.
St. Martin's.
No, it wasn't St. Martin's?
Oh, well, then which one was it?
It was All Points, which was I already forget who's that imprint of.
It's an imprint of, but I mean, it's a major publisher.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
And I think, you know, there is a part of you, and I've talked to a lot of people who've written books, who they want the stamp of approval, a legitimacy that comes from having a major publisher, because there's a sense in which that means you have something valuable to say. And that there.
Well, I also like the idea that because of the topic of that book, if I could get it through via a legitimate publisher, that would have been kind of an accomplishment because that meant I've gotten through that velvet rope.
Yes, that's true. That's an accomplishment in itself. And so you did that. So the advantage is there's some prestige if it's a good publisher. There is a possibility, but not a particularly great one, that they will take their marketing arm and flex it on your behalf. They won't necessarily.
You cannot hope for that to happen.
Yeah, no. Yeah, I talked about that in a recent episode.
Yeah.
In fact, I had a guest who said, your publisher will not help promote your book. Count on it. So he put it that starkly. The other thing is they will be more, you know, of course, more likely to be able to get the book in stores because they can flex a little bit for that. But beyond that, it's going to take forever unless they really crash your book, which they did for Meltdown, my book on the financial crisis, because they wanted to get that out so that it was still timely. But that's very rare. It's going to be, you finish that thing, you finish the final edit, it's going to be a year at least before it's in the stores, if not more, because you might be arguing with them about something else. So there are real drawbacks, not to mention, it's true that maybe you might be harder to sell completely on your own, but you keep a much larger chunk of the selling price than you do with the traditional publisher. So there are a lot of reasons you might want to go this route.
Oh, absolutely. You have to appreciate that 5 years ago, it was this or nothing. So the fact that we have options now is an enormously healthy step forward.
Hey, folks, as part of my sponsor message for BitTrust IRA, let me tell you what I gave two of my daughters for Christmas this year. I gave each of them 1/100th of a Bitcoin. Now, if you don't know about Bitcoin, that might not sound like a lot, but these days it kind of is. And I thought that giving them a stake in Bitcoin would be a great way to introduce them to it. And of course, a lot of people have become very interested in Bitcoin, especially over the past several years, and they know they should hold it, but the cryptocurrency world can be confusing. Well, one thing a lot of people have been doing is adding Bitcoin to their retirement accounts. And BitTrust IRA helps you seamlessly and securely add cryptocurrency to your portfolio. BitTrust IRA stores your private keys in nuclear bunkers with military-grade encryption. Plus, they have a 24/7 trading platform with no minimum investments and unlimited trades, plus a team to help guide you along the way if you have any questions. They also offer the lowest trading fees in the industry. Go to bittrustira.com/woods today to learn more. And for a limited time, BitTrust IRA is waiving the sign-up fee for Tom Woods Show listeners. That's a $50 value. That's bittrustira.com/woods. bittrustira.com/woods. When you're an author, you've never published before, you're going to try to go the self-publishing route, what do you do for the cover?
What do you mean?
Do you just go out and find a freelancer? And if so, where?
Oh, you mean if you're going through a publisher or you're doing
it independently? No, if you're on your own and there is no publisher designing a cover, where do you go?
Oh, so this is actually, okay, this is a very good question. Stay in your lane is my perspective. If you know how to write, that's great. Find someone who knows how to lay out a book. Find someone who knows how to do cover design and pay them. So that's the way to do it. Just there's no question about it. My buddy John, who did my theme song, it was his song that I used for my theme song for You're Welcome. I told him exactly how I wanted the cover to look like for Dear Reader. He did a superb job of it. He used the Superman font and he did the cover for Anarchist Handbook as well. And the thing is, this is what usually destroys independent books. There's lots of cues that this book is written by a hack. So make sure, for example, if it's all in one font, everything on the cover, that's usually indicated this person does not know graphic design.
Right. That's exactly. In fact, that's the kind of thing you don't notice until you're looking for it. It's the kind of thing, as we describe it to you, you think, I'm not sure why that would be. But then you put two books side by side and you realize, okay, I see which one is the professional one. Now, you can spend a fortune on a book cover. It just depends on your budget. You can also find inexpensive people who are up and coming designers. You can find them on various freelancer platforms. I personally think that the expression, don't judge a book by its cover, is a sweet little expression that doesn't describe reality. Sometimes people do judge books by their covers.
Of course.
At the same time, I've learned a lot reading books with hideous covers, but that book probably would have reached a wider audience if you'd had a better one. Now, the way I did it, the only self-published book I've done, I went through Amazon CreateSpace because that handles the layout for you. I don't have to hire a separate person. I send them the text, I pick the kind of template I want, the font I want, and then the thing gets automatically laid out and then I check it over.
I did not know that was possible, Tom. This is the first I'm hearing of this. I'm not joking.
Well, I think since then, they've ceased to offer that particular service, which is a shame because it made it so easy.
Wow.
I didn't have to reach out. So now I don't know what I would, I guess, again, I would go to a freelancing site and I would. And the thing is, there are so many people all over the world who can help you with almost anything. You can go to.
Book layout is not complicated if it's not illustration heavy because you just flow the text. I forget what the program is. I used it in college to do a newspaper, but it's not that hard.
So it's not hard to find. You don't have to find some hyper specialist or anything.
Exactly. Think about what it looks like. It's just you have the title on the top or your name on the left hand, page numbers. It has to have margins a certain way. There's going to be asymmetry between a left hand page and a right hand page. You don't want floaters where you have like a paragraph that's just one sentence hanging at the end of each page, but there's not that much to it. And choosing a font, whatever, that's professional. So but definitely, the more you can outsource, the better.
Yeah, honestly, you should not be struggling with this, trying to watch YouTube videos to figure out how it's done. There are some things that are worth paying money for. So for example, where would you go? There are sites like Upwork.com. If you're really on a budget, you can go to Fiverr, Fiverr.com. There's also Freelancer.com. These are places I've used multiple times. And sometimes when I've been on a real deadline, and let's say it's around Thanksgiving well, I don't want to bother some American designer or something around Thanksgiving. So I've hired a guy like from Egypt. Like, I don't even know what Thanksgiving is. I'm not bothering him. And, you know, the next day I've got this amazing thing in my inbox. So there are parts that would have been really annoying to do entirely on your own in the past. But now that you can tap into the talent of the whole world, it's not so hard to do. So that's what you do with the layout of the text. That's what you do with the cover. But is there anything else people need to know? I mean, I have suggestions about what to do to maybe try to get it in people's hands and get them to buy it. But in terms of the nuts and bolts of doing it, what else do they need to know?
I would definitely encourage people to get a copy editor to give it a one over, because things like the commas and the footnotes, like a lot of that's very technical, easy for your eye to miss.
Ah, that's right. And I've done that myself. I've done it for, yes, dare I say, one of my free ebooks, my ebook on the police. I just didn't feel like doing it. I could have, I just didn't feel like it. And I know a guy who does it for $25 an hour, and I said, here, you go do it. And it was great. So definitely you want to do that. Yeah, because your eyes going over at the same time, over and over the same words, are going to miss those mistakes. There are going to be a handful. And I've found, even in my books published with major publishers, I get the copy in the mail and I'm looking through it and I say, how could there still be typos in this thing? It's very, very hard to get rid of them all.
Well, the good thing with CreateSpace is that it's dynamic. So I've had a couple of typos in the Anarchist Handbook, but you can upload, since it's print on demand, you can just fix the manuscript and then it fixes it from them going forward, which you cannot do with a mainstream publisher.
You would have to wait for, if there even is a next printing, and who knows when that is.
They don't care. They don't fix them. I've had this happen more than once. There's a big typo. They don't care.
Oh. Well, again, this is a matter of your destiny being in your own hands when you're self-publishing. But then the issue is, now, in your case with the Anarchist Handbook, this thing was just insane that it took on a life of its own. Now, this isn't entirely the explanation. It's not just that you have a big Twitter following. It's very far from that, because a lot of people have big Twitter followings and their books don't sell at all. It must have been a combination of factors, but you used what you had at your disposal absolutely to your advantage. I mean, you used your podcast audience and the Twitter audience and your locals and, you know, the people who are hysterical for anything you put out. And you ran with that. Now, the average person, though, will come out with a book and maybe doesn't have, you know, 300,000 Twitter followers or something like that. So then the issue is there are hundreds of thousands of books coming out each year. Mine's only one of them, and I'm just a regular guy. Is there anything I can do to spread the word? I have some thoughts, but suppose you weren't Michael Malice. What would your approach be?
Well, if I weren't Michael Malice, then I would just, you know, give out my ebooks for free and be glad that anyone's willing to read this garbage, which can't possibly be of benefit to anyone, because as we understand under capitalism, if it has any value at all,
it will fetch a price. Yeah.
Something, anything.
Something.
People just out of their own conscience will want to give the person money because I've become better as a person from it. So there's lots of people who give away their books for free. It's a confession that they have no talent or likability whatsoever. But in all seriousness, this is something people don't appreciate. It's a cart before the horse. Like, I know very much what it was like, and I don't think you did. You weren't an aspiring author. I know it was like your thesis or your dissertation that became your first book, correct, Tom?
Yes.
Yeah, so you weren't writing it toward having it become a book. But I think a lot of people do want that authorship credential, and correctly so. It's a big accomplishment. You have a great opportunity now, thanks to things like Substack, to build your own audience, thanks to things like social media. So in my opinion, the audience should come first. And in fact, in terms of getting a book deal right now with a corporate publisher, you cannot do that without having an established audience, because they need to have some kind of demonstrated proof that you have people willing to pay money for your product and thoughts.
Right. They ask about that now much more often than they did when I first started writing books before, because the internet was still in its sort of fledgling state and nobody expected you to have a million Twitter followers or something. But now they want to know, they want the information about you. So,
and that's the other thing. It's like, from their perspective, and it's not unreasonable, if you can't get 10,000 people to listen to what you have to say for free, how the heck are you going to get 10,000 people to pay for what you have to say?
Right, right. So there are ways you can get in front of audiences. You can be a guest on a podcast that you know, covers the same subject matter as your book. And when you're a podcast guest, you won't necessarily get a million new names on your email list or on your social media, but the people you do get are the really engaged ones. Like they sat and listened to you talk for an hour, and then they said, I'm going to go out of my way to sign up to find out more about this person. That's a really hot prospect. So you get, you know, the numbers aren't as great as, let's say, if you had an email list of 100,000 people, you sent out an email about your book, but these are going to be very, very high quality people you get from being on podcasts. A kind of unique approach one of my listeners took was he had a book called Music Theory in One Lesson.
Oh.
And no one had ever heard of him before. And so what he did was he went into different Facebook groups and became a member. And these were all groups where people were struggling with music theory. And he would answer their questions, and then he would just have a little link to his site with his book on it. And he sold thousands and thousands of them this way. It didn't cost him anything. It cost him time. But he was able to build up an audience for himself that way simultaneously with selling the book. So there, you got to be creative.
But I mean, that is a rare situation where you have a title which he found a gaping hole in the market.
Yeah.
That's the kind of book where it's just like, you mean this hasn't been done already? This is...
Yes, exactly.
Like, I'm not a music theory person. That's not my interest. But clearly, this is a book that needs to exist.
Right. You can also make short videos related to the topic in your book, like really short, like on topics that people are searching for answers on. And you can make a little video, and then that promotes the book or promotes your newsletter or whatever. You might as well try the various free resources that are available to you. And then also thinking about somebody like Michael, do you know actually offhand how many Twitter followers you have?
321,200.
Okay, so it's a lot. And sometimes people might be inclined to say, well, it's easy for you. You've got, you know, all those Twitter followers. But the thing is, you didn't come out of the womb with those Twitter followers.
Oh, and let me correct you also. There's lots of people with bigger audiences than mine whose books are DOA.
Oh, absolutely. 100%. Yes.
Not that you're implying otherwise, but I think a lot of people think it's not at all the case.
It's not automatic. That's for one thing.
Because there's a huge difference. And this is something why I'm very big on curating your audience and blocking people, you know, and alienating them. There's a huge difference between I'll sit and watch your clown show for free, or I'm going to invest in you and I believe what you're doing. These are not the same phenomenon.
Right. So a lot of celebrities will have a lot of people who, oh yeah, I remember that guy in that movie. Yeah, I'll like him. But that's not the kind of person who follows you. Like, oh yeah, I saw him. I watched him for a few minutes on a podcast. No.
And also, and this is something which is internet 101, there's also the concept of engagement, right? I mean, we keep talking about Twitter. If you look at my Twitter account, and if you look at Reason, right, look at how many comments they have, how many likes they have or something like that. Then they have 300,000 followers, I believe. In terms of engagement, people replying, people having a conversation, banter, it's night and day.
Yeah.
And that's not all unique to them at all. There's many, you know, corporate media outlets who have like a million followers or some huge number. But in terms of people who retweet or like their stuff, it's like 7. It's a huge disparity.
You know,
and I don't even really have a good explanation.
Oh, okay, because that actually was going to be my follow-up. That the thing is, sometimes when somebody like you, you have some, I wouldn't say that you have absolutely no idea why that is. You have some idea of why, you know, how you built up this kind of audience.
I have no idea how a news outlet with 1 million followers will have literally 7 likes. Statistically.
Okay, yeah, that's, but either they're buying the likes or they're just really, really bad at this. I've seen a lot of people who are, they'll just post a link to an article and no comment. And then it gets no engagement. You can't do that.
Right.
But your situation is not so easily duplicated. Like that, I can think of people who follow a series of steps and then they get a certain result. But a good chunk of the reason for your success on Twitter is your unique personality. Right? And people follow you for the unique way you use Twitter and the unique way you entertain them.
Hopefully. I think that's great if that's the case. Yeah.
Yeah, I do too. All right. I mean, I want to sort of try and wrap up soon, but I'm going to put on the show notes page, which would be tomwoods.com/2038. Obviously, we're going to put the Anarchist Handbook on every single one of these episodes this week and remind you that the audiobook featuring Ole Woods here reading Rothbard is available. And we'll link to that too. It's a really nice way to consume the book. But I'll put links to the various freelancing sites that I mentioned. And I'm also going to have a link to, I have some videos on doing the Kindle version of your book and ways you can market. There are little techniques you can use to market the Kindle version of your book that will help you get some sales and build up an audience. But what are your final thoughts on this? Is there anything we overlooked?
Well, yeah, the just because you're dealing with Amazon doesn't mean it's going to be an easy process.
Oh, that's right. Can we just take a minute? I mean, you are publishing previously published material, I guess. It's a compilation of
right.
writings from different authors. And apparently that caused you some headaches. What was the problem? Was it saying that you don't have the permission to publish this?
So they're doing their due diligence as well they should. So Amazon recently rolled out a hardcover printing edition as well. So you could do Kindle, paperback, and hardcover. These three arms are independent of each other, which is just so stupid.
Yeah.
So I had to jump through all the hoops to get it through on Kindle. And they said, okay, show me these are public domain and or for the ones that aren't public domain that you've gotten their permissions, which I did. Then I had to do the same for the paperback. Then when I tried to put it through in a hardcover, they said, well, we don't think we can sell this, even though they are currently selling it and selling very well, because people are going to be confused because there's similarities between this chapter of yours called Anatomy of the State by Murray Rothbard and this other book out there called Anatomy of the State by Murray Rothbard. And I go, yeah, it's the same. And the reason it's the same is because I have permission from the Rothbard estate, which is in the first page with the copyrights, right? And here's the letter from Jeff Deist being very generous, giving permission. And you guys approved this already twice. And I went back and forth and they said, no, it's banned. You cannot do a hardcover. And when I tried to do the audiobook, you sign into Audible and you look for your name and it says, like, you know, which of these books do you want to make the audiobook? For some reason, I have never found out why, even though I can link to the paperback and see that as an option under my name. It simply says, this book is not available to be made into an audiobook.
So how was it ultimately resolved?
So what I did, which was smart to do anyway, is I got a distributor who takes your audiobook and sends it to literally 50 venues that sell audiobooks. It's not only Audible that sells audiobooks, it's iTunes, Apple Books, all these other places. And they basically distribute it for you. And they had to go through Audible 4 times, but they got it through.
Yeah, big pain in the neck. Well, I also, because the only self-published book I've done, Real Descent, was just a bunch of my previously published things that were available online or occasionally in print. And they must have done a thing where they don't just scour their existing titles. They must have some tool where they look around the internet and they say, well, look, we found a lot of duplicates here of what you've got in these different chapters. And so I had to explain to them that that's kind of the point of it, is that I've never published them in a book before. But most people writing books aren't going to run into that problem. But
yeah,
as you
course.
Say, don't assume that because it's Amazon, you figure, oh, they must know what they're doing. This will be a breeze. But sometimes it's not.
I just do want to point to people the frustration of having to wait like 5 days in between as they'll kick it back for the stupid bureaucratic reasons. And you're not going to be able to get a hold of someone.
Yeah, that's one of the really frustrating parts. You won't.
Yeah.
So on that note, everybody, head on out there. But you need to know going into it, the ups and downs. But it can do you a lot of good. And occasionally, like as with Michael with the Anarchist Handbook, you can have this breakout smash that, I mean, I think it also helped to, it elevated your profile even further. And it made you, even more than you were before, the authority on anarchism to have on other people's shows, right? I think it did serve as that kind of a calling card.
Yeah, and it's great that this book exists independently of me and what it means for me, that there is a collection that people can, you know, sample the different colors of the black flag.
Yes, that's right. And I like the fact, the same way that when I published my anthology of anti-war writing, I like the fact that this was a book that had Noam Chomsky in it. And did we have Howard Zinn? I can't remember. We had people all over the place. And it was genuine. It wasn't just my tribe and their anti-war stuff. It was all across the spectrum to give people the full sense of what this is all about. So I am also glad, and I was very happy to read the Rothbard chapter, and very pleased that you asked me to do that. So check out tomwoods.com/2038. We'll have some valuable links for you if you have any interest in publishing. And we'll also link to the Anarchist Handbook, which every cool person and plenty of extremely uncool people
yes.
own. So, all right. Thanks, Michael. We'll talk again tomorrow.
Thanks, Tom.
All right, everybody. That's going to do it. Links to everything at tomwoods.com/2038. So to Michael's book and to, again, episodes related to our topic for this week. We wrap up Michael Malice Week tomorrow. I'll see you then.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.